but the market is presenting opportunities. I mean, that's the one thing about a bear market, is that's the best time to be buying stocks. It sucks to be buying stocks in a bull market when you have to pay up and pay up and pay up and everything is getting more expensive. Buying things in a bear market, that's a great environment.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. Thanks for joining us for part two of our interview with macro analyst and capital manager Peter Buchvar. If you haven't yet watched part one of this discussion with Peter, in which he predicts even lower asset prices and a recession are essentially baked into the cake at this point, head over to our channel at youtube.com/Wealthion and watch it there first. It sets the context for the investment themes we discuss in this video. And we also tell you how to watch bonus footage of Peter explaining the origin story of how he became one of the most respected macro analysts in the business. So stick around to the end of the video for that. Okay, let's get started watching part two of our interview with Peter Buchvar. How important do you see what's going on in the housing market is to the risk of recession?
So with the home ownership rate, give or take, call it 65%, 65% of households owning a home with the balance that rent. So firstly, we're seeing a sharp decline in the pace of transactions, of new transactions, as the first-time buyer, and the first-time buyer is the one that gets really screwed here, because those that already own a home are sort of playing with house money. They've benefited from the rise in home prices that are up 20% year over year on top of a sharp increase the prior year. So there's a pool of equity in
prior home. Decade, but yeah.
Yeah, prior, exactly. So there's a pool of equity cushion that existing homeowners sort of are sitting on. But that first-time buyer there's no way a first-time buyer will be able to buy a home that's priced, or new home at least, priced less than $300,000. Now, so that is sort of a new world that we're in. So prices them out, it forces them to rent. And we know rent prices have been very aggressive over the past year.
Gone bananas.
The past 2 years. For new leases, they're running at 15 to 17%. If you're rolling over an existing one, it's still probably 10%. Or I should say maybe high single digits with a net aggregate about 10. So the first-time home buyer getting priced out. So with the existing owner of a home, well, I can't remember what the stat is, but I think it's north of 75%, probably more than that now, have a mortgage with a three handle or less. So now you have not mortgages at four or at five, but as you said, touching six. So the existing homeowner, unless they need to move because they need more space or they want to downsize, they're not giving up that cheap mortgage so quickly to go into a higher cost mortgage. So they're not going anywhere. The first time buyer is taking their time because they don't want to pay those high prices. The investor class, which has been a big driver in housing over the past couple of years in the single family rental business, where in some markets, they're almost a quarter of purchases. Well, you have to believe they're going to start questioning the IRRs of their new incremental purchases. So it puts a freeze on the entire industry, whereas so much then goes off that. So if there's less housing turnover, there's less new renovations being done, you may want to just redo your existing house, but people have been doing that the last 2 years through COVID. They put the deck on, they redid a kitchen, they put down new flooring.
And so, sorry to interrupt you, but they were doing that with much cheaper, like home equity loans rates, right? So it's a lot easier to borrow to do that 2 years ago than it is today, right?
Absolutely. So now they're doing it. Those existing homeowners are doing less on their existing homes. They already did it. And you are then taking away the possibility of, okay, I just bought this new house. I need to repaint it. I need to resand the floors and I need to touch up this or do that. Well, less transactions means less of that too. So the ripple effects are broad. You know, we go back to the Fed. You know, the Fed manipulates interest rates. The two most interest rate sensitive parts in the economy are housing and autos. the influence of manipulating interest rates on other things is much more difficult to quantify. But housing and autos is very easy. And I read an article over the weekend about car prices, new car prices, reaching another new high to the point where they're almost averaging where median income is. And the only way someone making 50 grand can afford a car is through cheap money. And money is not so cheap anymore.
Not cheap anymore, yeah.
So what a lot of people are now doing, that they had of leased, you know, it pays for a lease that's now expiring. It pays to exercise the option on that lease and buy the car, because the used car value is worth more than probably 3 years ago when you initially bought that car and where your option price is. So you can buy the car and then flip it. But then, of course, you then have to go out and buy a new car.
Right.
So it actually pays to buy it. But if you don't have the money to pay for it and you want to finance it, which is fine to do, you're having to pay up more than 5% interest rate on the money that you're going to borrow to pay off the car and then own it scot-free. Whereas before this sharp rise in interest rates, the cost of that was much less. You had 0% financing, and you were able to term out 7 to 8 years, or you had maybe at most 1 to 2%. So it's a whole new world with these big ticket items.
Yeah, it's the worst of both worlds, right? It's still record prices, at least with new cars, yet the highest financing rates we've had in forever, anybody can remember, right? And you talked about, the cars and housing being sort of two of the most interest rate sensitive sectors, which is true. I would say housing is even more so where the Fed's involved, because the Fed first sets, you know, the federal funds rate, which influences interest rates. So that's one way it influences mortgage rates. But then the Fed has also, until recently, been out there being the big buyer in mortgage-backed securities, right? So it's been keeping the cost of that debt low. And now it's no longer buying them anymore. And you have to figure out where the next marginal buyer is willing to set the price, right? Which is higher, right? So to use your terms, it's sort of a new world, right? And that's where I want to go with all this, because lots of reasons to expect that housing prices could go lower and maybe materially lower in a lot of areas over the next 1 to 2 years. And if you're interested in a really deep dive into this discussion, I recorded an interview about 10 days ago with Nick Gurley, who's a housing analyst. I'll put up a link to that video here. You can go watch it. But you know, we haven't even mentioned factors like inventory and whatnot, Peter, where there's now suddenly a lot more inventory that has been coming onto the market in past years, hitting markets in a lot of these areas, right as demand is beginning to slow. So it's kind of creating a bit of a perfect storm. So now I want to go into the recession question, because you did confirm that, hey, what happens with housing really does have a massive influence on the wealth effect, because you know so many people own it, and even rental prices are a function of what housing prices are. And even those people you mentioned who are sitting on a lot of home equity, still, if you've heard that your house has lost 20%, you know, if all of a sudden your house is worth 20% less than it was before, even if you're not planning on selling it, you still feel a little more fiscally conservative because you have less cushion than you did. Right. So one thing we haven't talked about yet, though, which would definitely also hit housing, is layoffs. So if this recession that we're heading into is big enough to have material layoffs in it, well, then to your point, yeah, if you're sitting on a 3% mortgage, yeah, you'll sit and just try to stay put for as long as you can. But if you lose your job and have to move for, you know, reasons that aren't really, you know, if you're being forced against your will, maybe to make the decision, as some people may have to be, you know, then you just sell your house with what you can get for it. And the house, you know, just like stocks, houses are priced at the margin, right? You just need a couple houses in your neighborhood to go for 15% below the current market value. And all of a sudden, everybody's houses are repriced downwards. So now we're at the recession question, Peter. What odds do you place at it, and how severe do you think it could be?
So because nothing is 100%, I'll say there's a 99% chance
that we'll I like how you left yourself some wiggle room there.
Yeah. So in case I'm wrong, I can say I didn't say 100. The extent of it is a good question, and something that I know a lot of us are trying to think about. whether it's going to be mild or severe. And it's tough to say, because usually when you look at the pendulum, the severe recessions follow the very fast growth, because you really swing in the other way. Whereas if the recovery is somewhat mild, the recession could be mild as well. And the problem, this economic cycle has been so screwed up by COVID that it's almost tough to define. Did the expansion really start in 09 and just temporarily disrupted in 2020? Or did it really begin in the depths of 2020 to continue now? I don't know. What I'm more worried about, because when you get if you get a sharp recession, they have a tendency of also snapping back quickly, just sort of like a V type situation. I think what potentially could be more worrisome is a mild one that stays mild, and that sort of a malaise kicks in where, let's just say, the Fed sort of pivots, they start to cut, but because this economic adjustment needs to take place, we don't really respond to a lower cost of capital. And that we get into this rut, and that US growth sort of goes back to maybe 1.5%, where it would be maybe 0.5% labor force growth and no better than 1% type productivity growth. That's somewhat lasts, sort of like the mid 2010s. We had rates at zero for 7 years, did nothing, all this QE, and growth just was sluggish. We can also debate that. That's for a variety of factors, but I'm more worried of just that than a sharp recession. Because like I said, sharper recessions have a tendency of snapping back quicker, where a mild one doesn't necessarily lead to a sharp rebound.
Okay, so let me tug at that for a little bit. Totally understand the concern there. You can almost look back at the mid-2010s now as like the salad days, right? So debt is higher now, and that's pretty much always true every decade, but debt's higher now, but certainly inflation is a lot higher now. So if the Fed pivots before taming inflation, you have a much higher cost of living going on. So, I guess my question is do you think we could even go back to those days of just kind of anemic growth? Because it seems like we've got a lot more weighing down the system right now, fundamentally.
Yeah, that's the scenario that I'm most worried about, sort of like a Japan type situation where, you'll get some periods of economic expansion followed by some moderation, where there's just not this sort of long runway of robust growth that we've seen.
Yeah, you just can't get back to escape velocity. You just keep right. Kind of mired. Yeah.
Yeah, because what are sort of the next things that we're gonna sort of bubble blow again? We've bubble blown so many things that you're almost running out of things to bubble blow. And now that you've bubble blown sovereign bonds, to use that as to me the epitome of this financial bubble, because you can argue that it's the greatest financial bubble in the history of bubbles.
Yeah,
it's tough to figure out what is going to lead to that next sharp, big economic expansion that's not driven by credit, because we're so now dependent on credit.
Yeah, all right. Well, look, let me go back to the quote from the intro by Christine Lagarde, which I think you could imagine, looking at the fundamental picture, Jerome Powell could make the same statement. I don't know if he ever will, just because he's, his job is to sell sunshine to a certain extent. But let's assume that she's right for a moment, so that we have further to go in terms of pain in the financial markets and the housing market really starts playing in. I guess first, let's go back to my question about layoffs. How concerned are you that we could potentially shift from this current narrative of, oh my God, we've just got way too many job openings, we're pegged at maximum employment. How concerned are you that could shift to suddenly being not a jobs glut anymore, but like a jobs drought, and actually having, millions of people losing their jobs again?
Well, we're beginning to see some of the early signs of it. of the pace of firings slowly ticking up. See that jobless claims data. Now, if you look at it in absolute number, it's obviously very low, but the trajectory has clearly changed. And it will be interesting to see, because companies have gone a couple of years desperate to find people. And you wonder, now that they have them, how quick are they going to be to fire them? The first inclination will be, let me just slow the pace of hiring.
Right. Job freezes.
Right. That's where we're going to be in certain industries right now. Now, the restaurant that needs extra help, they're still going to be searching for that person. But if you look at, for example, the big tech companies that we've specifically heard this from, that they're freezing hiring, that is the first reaction to an economic slowdown. That is the first reaction to profit margins that are compressing, and you're doing your best to try to protect it.
Yeah, and let me just chime in on that. I don't have the list in front of me, but I've read it before in previous videos. I mean, these are the big companies. These are the Microsofts, the Googles, the Metas, the Teslas,
Coinbase.
Coinbase. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, when we talk about, like, the indices and we say, hey, it's really the big companies that are kind of pushing the action around, you know, these are the big companies that are really setting the tone for the economy. And these guys are already at the hiring freeze stage.
Right. And you talk about, you know, bodies floating to the surface. What also happens in an economic expansion and money's flowing free is that companies just go on these hiring binges. They're all competing for high quality labor. They're all competing for any kind of labor if they feel like they need more of it, and they overhire. So not only is there the freezing of incremental hiring, then they start to say, okay, we overhired in this area. We overhired in this area. We don't need this role. We don't need this role. We can consolidate this. We can consolidate that. That is also now happening as well. And I expect, as we see, you know, the months that go from here, you'll see more of these so-called redundancies, as companies like to call it, as a nice way of saying firings. They call it redundancies. That will start to pick up from here as well.
Great. And, you know, I've been showing a chart, and I'll try to find it here again, of layoffs in the tech industry. And they're back. If you look at the Q2 chart here, we're not quite done with Q2 yet. There's still a little bit of time left, and we're already back up to levels that we were at, like, in July of 2020, you know, when we were bringing the entire global economy into shutdown. So it is a little bit of surprising to me, at least, to see layoffs at that magnitude this soon in the process. Because you're right, Peter, we generally go through the process of job freezes. Then you're doing cuts, right? You're like cutting bonuses, you're cutting hours, you know, maybe you're firing your contractors, but companies really try to delay as much as possible firing talent, because they're so costly to hire, and they want to make sure that they're really certain that they're going to go into slower growth ahead. So the fact that we're already seeing, you know, a noticeable number of layoffs this early in the stage, from my perspective, is kind of telling here. But anyways, Peter, go ahead.
You bring up an important point, because it's a lot of it in technology was where a lot of that sort of excessive hiring took place.
Overhiring went, yeah.
Right, because you look at it on the flip side, you look what's happening in the airline industry, is because there's not enough people, they're having to cancel thousands of flights every weekend, because they had such a retrenchment in response to COVID. Now that travel has rebounded basically to pre-COVID levels, staffing numbers have not even come close to rebounding to pre-COVID levels. So at least in that industry, you're not going to see that. You're going to see there's still the need for more pilots and flight attendants and FAA people and so on.
Right. And so you're right. We're in kind of the noisy part of the process here, where not every sector is experiencing this equally. In the airline space, it's a little bit different in the fact that this is sort of highly specialized. You can't just go pull a random person off the street and teach them to be a pilot. And if we do look at other sectors like retail, we have seen companies like Target, Walmart, and Amazon basically say, we're finding ourselves overstaffed. You know, we built up a lot of inventory because we were expecting demand to, you know, return as people are going back out again after COVID. And they've staffed up in advance for that. And they're finding, oh my gosh, we just have too much inventory and too many people sitting around not doing anything. So lots of noise, but I would say we're seeing more and more examples than we have for the past couple of years of overstaffing and companies that are looking to reduce versus hire. All right, well, so let's get down to brass tacks, Peter, here. The whole purpose of this channel is to help our viewers, regular people, better understand where the puck is heading, and you've done a great job of that in this interview on the macro side of things. But try to make capital allocation decisions so that, ideally, if we're entering into a more turbulent time like you and I think we may be, that they're less vulnerable to it, right? So you are a capital allocator. That's your day job. Given your macro outlook, what asset classes, what sectors are you finding more attractive given these conditions, and which ones are you most allergic to?
Okay, so breaking it down amongst different asset classes, we mentioned commodities. Well, I'll mention commodities. I think gold and silver, energy. They're well, at least in energy, they're major supply-demand imbalances still. Even though if we get some demand destruction in the economy, that will in the short term impact maybe energy prices. But I think secularly, one needs to be invested in energy stocks. I mentioned gold and silver. I've been bullish on them for a while, so this is not a new thing for me. But to tie into one's view of the dollar, I think that we might have seen an interesting inflection point with the Swiss National Bank raising 50 basis points. Only no rate change was expected. That led to a very sharp rally in the Swiss franc, which I think maybe could be an inflection point for this rally in the dollar. The dollar stops going up and then declines. That will be good for gold and silver. So one of the strategies that I manage is the global macro, and about a third of it still is focused on an inflation type theme. On the other equity side, investors really need to be valuation sensitive, which is another way of me saying I like value stocks relative to growth. And when looking at the value universe, I think people have to really see what companies can actually not skate through an economic downturn, because no one really can, but will be sort of less immune and can, and if anything, can better benefit and can actually benefit from an economic downturn where their competitors are run into trouble and they can gain market share throughout. Now, in terms of the economically less sensitive parts of the economy, we own CVS and Walgreens, to use that as an example of cheap stocks that are companies that are creating village neighborhood healthcare centers, where you get to see a doctor, a nurse practitioner, they get to fill you a script, and then when you walk out, you get a carton of milk, some shampoo, and some toothpaste. These stocks are pretty dirt cheap. I mentioned companies that can benefit from other difficulties. We own BrightView Holdings. They're the largest commercial landscaping company in the country with $2 billion of revenues. And one wouldn't think that, okay, let's invest in landscaping, but every day the grass grows and the trees need to be trimmed. And if you're going to have an office building, you're going to have a hotel, you're going to have a university, you're going to have to pay those bills. And you want to talk about a fragmented industry that, recession or no recession, this company has about 5% market share. There's a lot of growth ahead regardless of economic activity. We recently added to a position in Manchester United, the premier soccer league team, that if you were to price it at the same valuation that Chelsea was just purchased at, the stock price would be 50% higher. And the demand for sports is not going to change in an economic downturn. So just an example of some special situations, you can call it, some value situations, and trying to stay away from, should I buy Amazon? Should I not? Should I buy Google? Should I not? Those are the names that everyone's trafficking in. So try to look at places that have sort of been left for dead that others aren't focusing on, that it's not on the front page of Barron's, or getting a lot of press from analysts. Now, on the
Yeah.
fixed side, I'm
Sorry,
sorry.
if I can just interject here for a second. What I hear you saying is it's sort of a return to old school stock picking, right? Where you've said we like the value space, but you're looking for the good values in the value space that you think are they're mispriced right now, meaning they're actually the true value is better than what the current stock price is. And that's honestly, folks, what investing used to be before the Fed started pumping so much money into the markets that all boats rose and you could just throw a dart in an ETF and ride it.
Right. And there's some and some uniqueness to the business. You know, there's only one premier soccer league, and there's, you know, Manchester United, if you look at their social media coverage, it's greater than the Yankees, Cowboys, Patriots combined. I mean, it's extraordinary, the reach. You look at Madison Square Garden Entertainment that owns Madison Square Garden. They have a long-term lease on Radio City Music Hall and the Beacon Theater, Chicago Theater. They're building at the Sphere in Las Vegas. They own Tao Hospitality. You know, these are unique franchises, and the stock is trading below where it was in March 2020 when every one of their businesses was shut down.
Right, really interesting. Yeah, it's funny. You're saying Manchester United, you buy it for the sports company, but it's actually, you get a media company for free.
Well, that, yeah, but, and Madison Square Garden Entertainment, that stock trading below where it was at the depths of COVID when everything was shut down. So there are unique instances that I don't know where they're going to trade over the next 6 months, but the market is presenting opportunities. I mean, that's the one thing about a bear market is that's the best time to be buying stocks. It sucks to be buying stocks in a bull market when you have to pay up and pay up and pay up and everything is getting more expensive. Buying things in a bear market, that's a great environment. But those with time horizons, things are going to get cheaper. Cheap gets cheaper, oversold gets more oversold in a bear market. And I don't know when that end will be. I have an idea of possibly what range is, but this is the time with people with long-term time horizons to be buying stocks. And lastly, on the fixed income side, and we mentioned we like short duration, high quality bonds that you actually get an interest rate with a plus sign in front of it and something greater than 1%. So that's attractive, not certainly relative to inflation, but given the fixed income landscape that you're playing in, it's better now than it's been.
Right. And that goes to the, you know, for a long time, it was TINA, right? People would use to justify putting larger than historical percentages of their portfolios into equities because they said this, you just can't get a return elsewhere. It's not a world beating return, but you're now actually beginning to get attractive returns on a relative basis in the fixed income space. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that the 10-year now over 3% is beating, and maybe even by a decent margin, the average dividend rate of stocks, of the average stock. Is that true?
Yeah, the S&P 500 dividend yield is about 1.7-ish, I think. 1.6, 1.7, maybe even to 1.8, but even, you know, within that, you're talking about a 10-year yield that's almost twice that. So that definitely is a very good point that you make. And one last thing, you know, I mentioned the possibility of a topping out in the U.S. dollar if the behavior post Swiss National Bank was any indication, is international markets could start to outperform U.S. markets if that were to be the case. We are particularly bullish on the Asian region when looking out over the next 5 to 10 years. You know, we talk about the potential recession in the U.S. and that even in a recovery, maybe we're only going to grow 1.5%, maybe even get to 2%. Well, Europe is going to see sluggish growth. The only area of the world that I see that has the prospect for strong growth looking out 10 years, it's the Asian markets. It's this growing middle class. It's 4.5 billion of the 8 billion people in this world that live in Asia. And that growing middle class to me is a tremendous thematic secular play that in the short term, because of what China is doing and so on, could be inhibited. But looking out longer term, we're pretty bullish on that region.
All right. I'm going to try to find an image and overlay it here while I'm talking. But it's an image that blew my mind when I first saw it, where it's a map of the world with a circle drawn over China. I think it includes India and maybe gets as far as Indonesia. But it's definitely a relatively small part of the surface area of the entire world. And it says more people live inside this circle than live outside of it, which encapsulates what you're talking about here, Peter. And Jeremy Grantham, who has been long saying, look, this everything bubble is going to end in tears and has been pretty loudly predicting its demise over the past year. He has basically said there's not a lot of great opportunities he sees in the current environment, but emerging markets was one of them. And to his credit, he said they'd probably go down, you know, before the dust settles, but he sees great long-term potential there. It sounds like this is the type of the same reasons he's interested in that, the same reasons you're interested in this geography, correct?
Absolutely. And, you know, I know people say emerging market generically speaking, I particularly like emerging Asia, and India is one of our most positive themes.
Yeah, you're all about that circle.
Yes.
All right. Well, look, Peter, thank you so much. As expected, fantastic discussion. Really appreciate you giving us so much time. And I really appreciate you sitting down briefly and giving us your origin story, which, folks, if you want to hear how Peter got to the place where he is now, being one of the most widely respected macro analysts and capital managers, just go to wealthion.com/bookvar. That's BOOKVAR. And you can hear Peter tell his story there. But Peter, for folks that have really enjoyed this interview, maybe didn't know you so much beforehand and would like to get to know you and your work and follow you, where can they go?
Well, I have a newsletter where I write daily. It's called The Book Report, and they can go to bookreport.com, BOOKReport.com, and they can trial it. And if they like it, they can subscribe. And then the wealth management firm that I'm with is at bleakley.com, and they can learn more about our services, and if interested, can reach out.
All right, fantastic. And Peter, when we edit this, I'll put the URLs to both of those up on the screen. But again, thanks so much for giving us so much of your time, Peter. Really looking forward to have you back on again soon. It's been awesome.
Thanks, Adam. I appreciate the opportunity. Always fun.
All right. Well, now's the time of the program where we bring in the lead partners from New Harbor Financial, one of the endorsed financial advisory firms by Wealthion, to react to what Peter just said in this interview and to talk briefly about what's happening in the markets. I'm joined today by Mike Preston. John Lodra has the week off. Mike, great to see you. So real quick, you know, the main theme of Peter's discussion there was margin compression and how we're likely to see more of that coming ahead as the Q2 earnings announcements reveal the margin compression that's currently going on and then begin to bring down earnings estimates for next year, which will further depress potentially stock prices. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Peter talked about margin compression, and I think that that process has probably just started. There's a lot of reasons for that. I mean, I think that most people can see the prices of things going up around them, most notably energy prices. You know, gas here in the East Coast in New England is over $5 a gallon. Adam, I feel for you guys out on the West Coast, I think it's more around $7 a gallon. It's pretty crazy.
It is, and sorry to interrupt, I'm going to put up a little image here of recent gas prices that actually Elon Musk tweeted this out, and you'll look at it and you'll get a chuckle.
And I mean, energy goes into everything that we wear, drive, eat. Energy, you can't make anything productive without energy. I think we all know that. And so energy prices are going up, and literally everything else is going up in price too. But it's not only that prices are going up, we're starting to see supply chain shortages that are likely to last for years. Most people probably see empty spots on grocery shelves. If you're looking for used auto parts or things like that, good luck. It's difficult to find a number of different things, and that's likely just starting. And labor costs are going up. We've seen a shrinkage in the workforce. Look at what's going on with the airlines right now. You know, a lot of pilots have retired early, and it's difficult to find skilled labor. All of this is to say that there are going to be margin pressures. And when there's margin pressures, that basically means that companies make less profit. If you look at how you measure the valuation of the stock market, it's basically price divided by earnings. Valuations go down by either price going down or basically earnings going down as well can inflate a PE. So if earnings go down, even if the price of the stock market goes down, which it will under margin compression, you could still have a very overvalued market, even if it were to be, for instance, 50% lower than here. I mean, take a look at what happened in 2008, 2009. You know, PEs went sky high even as the market collapsed because earnings collapsed. So that could absolutely happen again. And it's happening now at a time where valuations, that is, pr- price divided by earnings have really never been higher, even after this roughly 20% decline in the S&P. We're getting a bit of a bounce here. Today's Monday, the 21st of June, which I guess is also the longest day of the year.
Tuesday, 21st of June, but yes.
Oh, that's right. It's Tuesday.
We had the holiday yesterday.
Yesterday was a stock market holiday. Forgive me. That's right. So it feels like a Monday. So we're getting a bit of a bounce here, but you know, the market is still down only roughly 20% from the high. And everywhere you see in the media, talk is about what to buy next, what to buy in the dip. I mean, if you look at your average financial media, it says, what's the next play? Everyone is still very keen on buying this dip. It's a very, very difficult and dangerous market. And we believe that we are in the early phases still of a bear market. And we haven't even really seen the first panic move down yet. The market's roughly at around 3,800 or so in the S&P. I'd expect it to get to around 3,200 to 3,400 maybe on that first panic move down. And that would likely only be the first wave or the first move, in my opinion. So be careful. Use the bounce to reposition yourself. If you're too heavy in equities, it would be a good time to lighten up a bit.
All right, great. So a reiteration of that point, use any rallies at this point to lighten up, move more to cash, get more defensive. So agree with everything you said, Mike, and I just want to sort of hammer home for folks here. The reason why I think we can have good confidence in further continued margin compression here is here's what corporate America is experiencing right now. They're experiencing higher input costs, right? And we've seen that, you know, with all this inflation, that the PPI, the producer's inflation, is actually increasing at a faster rate than consumer price inflation. And we know consumer price inflation is really high, right? We can all see it when we go to the market or fill up our gas tanks. But producers are experiencing that even more, meaning they can't pass all of the cost inflation along to their end customers. So they're having to eat the difference, which is reducing their profitability. Then they're also experiencing an increase in the cost of capital out there, right? As the price of debt is going up, it's more costly for them to borrow. And so they have higher debt service costs. And again, that eats into their profits even further, right? And then on top of that, you have the demand destruction that's going on right now. And there's two big forces bringing demand down. One is just the natural organic high prices tend to cure high prices, right? Things get so expensive, then people just start buying less of them. And we're already seeing that right now. You see, you know, retailers like Walmart and Target and Amazon, you know, show that they're having spiking inventories because they stocked up and the consumer demand they expected didn't show. And now they've got a bunch of employees that are not being fully used here, right? So you've got that. And then, of course, you've got the Fed out there continuing to raise interest rates and doing everything it can to continue to bring down the cost of debt, which is having a knock-on effect in the housing market and so on and so on. So basically, you know, going forward from here, that negative wealth effect is only looking like it's going to build in the coming quarters. And so that's going to reduce people's desire to buy things, right? So they're getting squeezed on the profits and they're going to be getting squeezed on the revenues as fewer people buy things. And I see you nodding here as I say this, Mike. So what's so important about this, and Peter and I talked a fair amount, is, you know, it seems pretty hard to imagine that we're not going to be headed into recession. I think I asked Peter his probability of it, and he said a 99% probability because he just wanted to give himself that 1% just to have a little bit of wiggle room because nobody knows anything for certain. But I want to contrast that with a clip that was just made about an hour ago, Mike, or released an hour ago by the White House, where the press secretary was asked if the White House saw a recession coming, and she sort of stammered, and I felt bad for the position she was in, but she ended up saying, quote, we do, quote, not see a recession right now. Instead, we are in a transition to a place of steady and stable growth. And boy, I don't know what hallucinogenic lens they're looking through to make that prediction. But I feel for them because I do not think that that prediction is going to age well at all. What do you think?
I don't think it will either. We are at a, like I keep saying, a very dangerous place. You can measure that with valuations. Math will matter. I suppose you don't know exactly when, but in my opinion, the chart tells me that we're 6 months, almost 7 months into this bear market already. if this is indeed the bear market that I think it will be, and that is one of the biggest in our lifetimes, that that prediction is guaranteed to be wrong. You know, we might very well already be in a recession. The stock market certainly seems to be signaling it. And like you said, margins are going down, prices are going up. It's only a matter of time before we see, you know, we see the true recession, and we see some financial panic. I can't really blame them for saying this. It is an unfair question. They have to spin everything positive. It would send the wrong signal.
The old, bureaucrat, when it gets serious, you have to lie, right?
Yeah, it stinks that that's the system we live in, but it's true. What I like about this program, about you, Adam, and the people you have on here, is we all try to tell the truth. Really, there's just no reason not to. And I certainly don't want to be seen as a doomsayer, but I think the stock market will lose more than half its value, probably even from here, ultimately, and that we're probably about ready to enter one of the largest economic contractions that we've seen in a long time, maybe even bigger than the 08-09 timeframe. Now, predictions are dangerous because nobody knows for sure the future. I can only say conditions are right and the data says that's what should happen. And the only question left unanswered is, will central banks be able to avert it? Will they be able to keep us on a permanently high plateau? We don't think that they can.
All right. Well said, Mike. Well, look, we're going to keep this relatively short here because we're going to have you back on again later this week as we get further into the market. But real quick, you know, you just made a fairly big comment there, which is that you think that, you know, we could have a correction / recession here, kind of on par of what we went through in 08. And even if it's just close-ish to that, that's a pretty big deal. You're in the business of talking to people day in and day out about preserving their wealth. You know, the fact that you're a financial advisor and that's your job is to fiduciarily to help people grow, protect and grow their wealth. So kind of looking, seeing that type of future ahead, you know, is there anything that you're telling people right now or any particular concerns that people are calling you up with right now and you're having to give them some counsel about how to stay sane and chart a prudent course from here?
Well, a couple things. I mean, if they're not clients of ours, and we talk to a lot of people that are not clients of ours, we're happy to do it. We do it every day. And we're happy to give our opinion and to help where we can. The biggest thing is a number of people are still over-allocated, at least in their position or in their opinion, because they're seeing their accounts down, you know, quite a bit, particularly because bonds are down. And there's a lot of deer in the headlights going on. We talked a few weeks ago about how we thought we were in a bear market rally, and that was a good time to realign yourself and maybe reduce equities in particular. And then we had, I think it was last week, early last week, we had three big down days in a row that kind of caught people off guard. And here on Tuesday, the first trading day of this week, we're getting a big bounce. And if it continues for a couple more days, or even if it doesn't, it just goes sideways for a while, I think that people are going to feel a little bit more relief and say, well, maybe we're going back to normal. I don't think we're going back to normal. I do believe that we're, you know, this first big leg hasn't even finished yet. And we're probably going down to around 3,200 to 3,400. So here at 3,800 on the S&P, it would be a really good time to take some action. And we're here to help people start taking action, even verbally. They don't have to be our clients, and happy to talk to anybody and help them through how to think through that and take action on it. It doesn't have to be sell everything to cash. It could literally be sell 25% today, sell to another 25% a couple of days from now. I really think that people will be happy that they started to realign their portfolio with what their risk tolerance really is. People don't know what their risk tolerance is until things start going down. So I think that's the biggest thing, you know, is to just basically take some action. I know I've said that before, but definitely do that. And for the investments that you do have, think about real assets. If you're going to make any new investments, think about real assets, gold, silver, commodities-based things. Those should do well in the years ahead.
All right. Great, Mike. Well, great counsel. And just quickly wrapping things up here. So I did mention that I asked Peter his origin story about how he came to become the big money manager and macro expert that he is today. If you want to watch that, it's a great video to watch after this one. Just go to wealthion.com/bookvar. That's B-O-O-C-K-V-A-R. I'll put a link to it down beneath the description of the video here. Also, if you haven't heard me mention it before, because we see so many potential warning signs of a recession coming ahead, that I highly recommend that anybody that works for a paycheck, you take prudent steps today in advance of its arrival to make sure that you're better positioned in case it ends up impacting your employer and thereby potentially your job. We have a layoff survival guide, totally free. If you haven't yet read it, go to wealthion.com/layoffs and read it there. And if you enjoyed this presentation, this interview with Peter, would like to see both him back on and other great guests of his caliber back on this program in the future, please help support the Wealthion channel by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. All right, folks, that's it. So feel free to go watch that bonus clip at wealthion.com/bookvar. Mike, thanks for joining us quickly this week. Look forward to having you back on in just a couple of days. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.
I really appreciate it, Adam, and I look forward to talking to you again this week. See you soon.